Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio dialogue. I'm here with Nora Bateson. Nora is the founder of the Bateson Institute. She is a filmmaker, an author, and an educator. But what I would want you to know about her personally is that Nora is one of the most exciting thinkers that I know of. I make it my habit of seeking out people who are thinking beyond the edge of our current paradigm and into the next paradigm. And Nora is definitely one of those people that I have found most consistently exciting for the whole time that I've known her, which I think at this point must be at least a decade. And she never ceases to amaze me with the way that she's thinking and how she's presenting ideas. So today we're going to speak about her book, Small Arcs of Larger Circles. It's a new book, which obviously I highly recommend, and we're going to go into some aspects of it. There's many too many amazing ideas for us to cover them in the span of time that we have, but it's my pleasure to introduce you to Nora Bateson here during this audio dialogue. So Nora, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here with you, and I look forward to our conversations because they always go into uncharted, unscripted, unnamed territories that are exciting and full of possibility. So I'm just looking forward to see where this goes.
Great. Okay, thank you. So, you know, there's so many places I could start in terms of both what I already know about you, but specifically even in terms of the many things that you cover in Small Arcs of Larger Circles. But I thought I'd start with something the most general. There is a place in the book where you define life. And you define life as relational mutual learning context. Now, I realize that that is packed with lots of ideas, but I wanted to start. I just always think that that someone who's an innovative thinker is thinking from a foundational view of reality, of life, of existence. And I wanted to sort of give you an opportunity to express to us what your view of life is, what your view of reality is. And then we can look at some of the specific things you go into in the book in more detail.
So you want me to describe what I mean by mutual learning contexts in interrelationship? I guess I would like to start by kind of giving an idea of why I came to that collection of words and ideas. And part of that is that in my work, I'm working with life in many different ways. In human life, social life, the life of ideas, the life of biological organisms and ecologies, the life of all sorts of possibilities. In one of the trickiest questions, I think, of this era is the question of what's the difference between a living system and a non-living system? And it's a question that I'm very humbly going to say I'm not exactly sure what the answer to that is. And I would hope that others would be careful to not jump in to a finite definition there either. These are tricky questions, and it matters. For me, I think ultimately it matters so much that I was becoming aware of the limitations of describing life in terms of various roles or repeated behaviors or even patterns. I mean, I come from a lineage where patterns are really important, but that there was something else. And the second you try to diagram a living system, one of the things that happens is you freeze it. And I felt uncomfortable with that. And the reason I felt uncomfortable is because life doesn't actually stay still. The Jeff that is Jeff is not the Jeff that will be Jeff. And if I draw a diagram of Jeff, while that diagram of Jeff might be true for a minute, but it's not an eternal diagram of Jeffness. And you can say the same thing for a field or an ocean or a redwood tree or a business or a governance structure or there is a lot of different systems that you can apply that thinking to. And the real difference for me is that I'm trying to highlight through this work. There are a lot of ways of describing systems. What I'm bringing forward to add to the collection is this notion of mutual learning. That whenever we're in any kind of interrelationship, that interaction over time is learning. I don't mean learning as necessarily a positive, progressive, developmental process. We can learn to be in very destructive relationships. We can learn to be addicted. We can learn to withhold affection. We can learn to be aggressive. So when I'm speaking of learning, I'm speaking of it in the sense that it's a process of interaction of simultaneously taking into account the other entities that we're in relationship with and how we form through those relationships. So you could look at a tree in the forest, and that tree could be crooked and craggly, and it could be bent in all sorts of ways. And that tree is responding exactly to all the stories and the interactions that it's living within. It's responding to its contexts of interaction. Where's the water? Where are the microbiomes? What microbiomes? What kind of light? What kind of wind? What kind of other trees and other shade is it sharing the light with? What is the interaction with the human world where that tree is? And so on. And the form of that tree is an illustration, partially of that tree. Is it an oak? Is it a fir? Is it a redwood? But partially, that tree is a unique illustration of its contextual relationships. How is it learning to be in its context? And you can find another tree, same kind of tree, same species, maybe even in the same forest. And that tree could be straight and tall. And that tree is responding to the context that it's within. And so then when we ask ourselves about change, okay, because this is really what we're asking. How do we change systems? What is systems change? When we start to ask that question, it's important that we look at how mutual learning is part of what we're talking about. To the crooked tree, if we want to change that tree, how are we going to change that tree? Now, if we start off, we walk up to it, we say, this tree is the wrong shape. We need to change the shape of this tree. So we might force that tree's branches into the shape that we want it to be in. We could tie them, we could clip them, we could arrange that tree so that it fits better into our notion of perfect treedom. But given time, it's probably going to go back to the shape that it was in before or something similar, because it is actually needing to be in those interdependencies, in those relationships that it was in before. So is the crookedness then in the tree? Mm. And you could ask the same thing about a lot of other pathological situations. Is the addiction in the addict? Or is it in his relationship to his family? Is it in relationship to his idea of happiness or success? Is it in relationship to the sort of economic structures that provide things like black markets of drugs? Or is it in the idea that we need to take a pill to solve a problem? Where's the addiction? So it's that kind of question that I'm looking for with this work, is the question of looking at whatever it is we want to look at, whatever it is we want to study, whatever it is we want to ask about change within, and to ask not how is it broken and how do we fix it, which is currently the way we do things, but to ask how is the way that this whatever, tree, person, organism, organization, behaving that shows us how it's making sense of its world. How is it learning to be in its mutuality of relationships? So that's really where that's coming from.
Beautiful, thank you. During this interview, I'm going to take the liberty of relating some of the ideas in your book and the language you use in the book to ways in which I teach, mainly because I see a big part of the audience for this dialogue being people who are working with me. So I want to give them ways to connect things they're already working with. And so as it sparks, I'll do that. So I'm prone to talking about our current conception of reality as a things in space conception. So there's a foundational belief that we live in infinite three-dimensional space populated by things. And although that has been valuable for, you know, some hundreds of years and yielded all kinds of scientific discoveries, et cetera, it's reached the limits of its possibility field. And so what I propose as language to replace that language is unfolding continuity. Because I think, and I think you and I would agree with this, that a lot of the language of interconnection, which you talk about in your book, I think falls into the things in space assumption. So it becomes separate things that are connected versus, I think, what you're speaking about. And in your book, you go into these very interesting distinction between unity and one. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about between unity and oneness, right? So oneness can be thought of as a kind of amalgamated, you know, what another exciting thinker that I know, Timothy Morton, talks about, the blah. You know, it's a kind of an amalgamated, undifferentiated blah. And that's not what unity is. Unity has to do with something more difficult to grasp, which is not interconnected separate things on the one hand, and it's not an amalgamated oneness on the other. It's a unified whole or continuity of elements that are not separate. So it's, you know, it doesn't compute because we don't really have the logic to compute such a thing. So now that I'm hearing you say that life is a relational mutual learning context, what that's evoking for me is a system of elements that are all changing all the time in relationship to each other. So there's an element over here that's changing because it's in relationship with every other element in the field. And each of those elements is changing as a result of all the other. So nothing moment to moment is identical, but and everything's changing in relationship. Because everything is changing consistently, then how it's affecting the whole is constantly also changing. You know, it's multidimensional changing is happening all the time. So it isn't even like a static group of things. And I think this gets to something which I can't remember if you said it now or you said it when we were speaking earlier, but the difference between possibly a living system and a mechanism. You know, a mechanism is a collection of static things that are interacting, but they themselves don't really change. And in a living system, all of the individual elements that are interacting are also always changing. So no element is the same moment to moment, and the system as a whole isn't the same from moment to moment. And I guess that's where you get into a level of complexity that gets very difficult, well, maybe impossible to manage in the sense that we normally use the term manage. So maybe that's an entree into asking you to speak a little more about complexity, because that's certainly something that you talk about quite a bit. And I think you mean something more complex than the term usually indicates.
So the term for this context of mutual learning that I have been developing is this term. It's a new word. The word is semathesy. You have to say it 20 times before it fits in your mouth. But the sim comes from the Greek together, and the mathesy comes from the Greek learning. So to talk about a semathesy is to talk about a context of mutual learning. So I'm a semathesy. You're a semathesy. A forest is a semathesy. A city is a semathesy. And then there are small versions, inside versions, right? So much like we might use the term systems. But this is a little different because instead of being like you are talking about this notion of arrangement of parts with roles that do their thing, that form a kind of, you know, in systems we get this idea that there's this way in which things are linking together. And even the language, we say that it's functional or it's not functional. We talk about parts and wholes. We talk about this notion that is more similar to kind of a squishy Swiss watch than it is to this idea of, you know, getting back to that tree of all the vast interactions that are taking place. And part of that is the limitation of our own willingness to embrace that complexity. That we have this, I think, erroneous idea that simplicity is the opposite of complexity, and that what we're looking for is simplicity. Okay, I just want to say that's bogus. Simplicity is very complex. The simple want that I might have at 9 o'clock for a piece of chocolate is a simple want. But underneath that is this incredible complexity of not only my biological rhythms, but my relationship to my own body, to the day itself, to the way I think about to where the chocolate comes from, there's a whole process inside something we might call simple. The opposite of complexity is not simplicity. It's reductionism. It's reducing those relational interactions and separating whatever it is we want to talk about from those relationalities. And that can be really very violent. It leads us to the idea that we can objectify something, that we can pull something out of its relationships. A person, a plant, anything can be removed from that within which it is interdependent. And somehow that we can know that thing, that we can talk about that thing that's floating in space at this point in your, you know, space full of things. It's lost its nest. And somehow that has become habituated and very mistakenly understood as simplicity. And it's not simplicity. It's a mess. Sometimes we have to do that. You know, it's really important to be able to look at things up close and in detail and in this notion of unity that we're talking about. You know, unity is about relationality. How can you have interrelationships and interdependency if you don't have difference? So the vitality itself of a system is inside those, that learning, processing, moving squishiness of life. But my hope is that in talking about it in terms of context of mutual learning, that it's actually easier to feel the real simplicity of it. I mean, it's not hard, right? You can think of your very best friend and you can think of how you know that person to be responding in their lives to their circumstances. And you can, because you love them, you can start to see that the way that they are in interaction with their world is the way they're learning to be in their world. And the same way you might see that with a crooked tree. It's not that hard in the sense of difficulty, but it's very complex. And so my hope is that in that sense, we might be able to also get a little more comfortable with complexity and be a little more ready to embrace it, to be able to say, I am complex. Am I, you know, you were saying what it, who I am, right? And who am I? Am I these millions of organisms that live in my digestive tract? Am I my culture? Am I my education? Am I my relationships to my kids and my family, my ancestors? Am I my work? And the answer, of course, to all of that is yes. I am all of that and more and more and more. And it's all changing. And that's complex. And at the same time, I'm just me. And if I were to put the brakes on that learning or the brakes on that complexity, it would be a huge violence. So I wouldn't do that to myself. I would give myself that room. And as an act actually of love, I would give you that room. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that I could give everyone that room to be in that complexity, in that state of simathesy, of mutual learning within the context, so that when they do something or manifest something that I would like to pass judgment on or fix or find a solution for, that I might begin to look at more than just the more than just the individuated symptom, and to be able to look at a larger systemic contextual process. So this book has a lot of different voices in it. And I broke all sorts of rules. It's poetry, it's essay, it's philosophy, it's about love, it's about family, it's about food, it's about fascism, it's about all sorts of things. And ultimately, it's about a willingness to respond to those things in their complexity from my own complexity. So a lot of times we hear about complexity and there's a certain kind of aesthetic, there's a certain voice, there's like the way that we talk about complexity is it has a academic feel to it. It exists in an only sort of intellectual realm. It's bifurcation and it's decoupling and it's all kinds of math mixed in with other diagrams and so on and so forth. And I'm taking all of that on board and I'm adding to it. I'm not going to naysay that. I'm just going to ask, where's the feeling? Where's the aesthetic? Where's the part of this that shows me how this thing over time is responding? I say complexity is okay.
Great, thank you. Okay, so I think where I want to, this often happens, but I have kind of competing directions to go in, but I'm going to pick one and go. So I asked you about your definition of life, which is relational mutual learning context. And you just made that very clear in a variety of ways. I wanted to just take a moment more with the term context, because in the way that I've been addressing the idea of context with people, I've essentially been saying that we've been trained, you know, in our things in space way to really give the majority of our attention to content. We're trained to work with content. And the context within which we're working with that content is more often than not invisible to us and not generally considered of primary importance. So part of what I like to facilitate is to increase people's understanding of context and explore the ways in which we can begin to work directly with context, work with the thing that we usually just take for granted. And so just historically, I'm very fascinated by the development of a kind of American spiritual philosophical tradition. And ever since I've met you, I've kind of put your father in that tradition. I don't know that he would put himself in that tradition, and he wasn't American, but I think that's immaterial. I don't think the American tradition that I'm talking about has necessarily to do with a particular country. But, you know, one of the central philosophical figures in American academics was William James, and he spent a lot of time speaking about the relationship between content and context, and specifically the fact that we have an erroneous notion that they're separate. And he talked about how elements play the role of content or context interchangeably. At one moment, it's the content, it's the foreground. At another moment, it's the background to something else. And I feel like that's part of the complexity. That sensibility is part of what I get through your book. And that there isn't just a context, and there isn't even just multiple contexts. There's this shifting of context and content in a very ongoingly dynamic system. So I wanted to just open this up for you to say a little bit more about the context. How do you see context? And I want to relate that to, because you gave us, in speaking about just now, semathesy, which is a term I'm really, you know, I've only been introduced to it recently, but I'm loving it. You just gave us, I think, mainly you were just now focused on the noun version of semathesy. And so I want to somehow marry your ideas of context to the verb form of semathesy, which you define in the book as to generate contextual mutual learning through the process of interaction between multiple variables in a living entity. And so, yeah, I just want to ask you to speak about semathesy as a verb, as something that you do in beyond something that you are. So, you know, I kind of have this sense that semathesy is a vision for who we are and what we do. So I just want to turn that over to you.
Okay. So as a verb, you might ask, how do you semathesize some new event or piece of information or input? And that's a way of saying, okay, so let's say you get a raise in your work. And you would ask, how does that semathesize? So what happens to the whole, how does that information go in and contextualize into your family, into your emotional state, into your sleep patterns, into your whole, all the contexts of your life are going to be informed by this new stimulation in different ways. You might have friends that are jealous. You might have kids that are suddenly feel that it's okay for them to spend more money than they did before. You might have a certain sense of cultural acceptance at a level that you are trying to figure out how to be in. So the way that that information is somathicized is about how it goes into the multiple contexts of your world. Ultimately, that's an aesthetic question. It's an aesthetic question that has actual practical actionings in the world. But nevertheless, it's coming through this process of how this information goes in and becomes part of multiple contextual relationships that are changing, that are shifting.
I'm just going to ask a follow-on question to that. Because as you're speaking, I'm relating it to something else that I share with people that I think I'd love to hear your comment on in relationship to the verb form of somathesy, which is, I will often say that, you know, in the mindset of things in space, the operating system that we adopt is individual achievement. So we become a thing that envisions goals and then strategizes to achieve them. In a mindset of continuity unfolding, the operating system needs to shift to what I like to call circumstantial emergence, which means we recognize that everything that happens is an emergence out of a circumstance. And we need to spend more attention to the influence we can have over circumstances that will allow unfoldings to occur. And so give up control of the unfolding of what actually occurs and use the influence that we do have, which is not infinite, but is not zero either, to help create circumstances that have the most beneficial emergences. So I'm seeing that as possibly, it could be understood as a form of somathesy. You were just speaking about somathesy as a verb in terms of how a new element shifts the whole. And I just wanted to have you respond to it in terms of how we might influence circumstances, influence contexts, in order to create different results than what we might be currently seeing.
Okay, but this is a super tricky question. And it's tricky at several levels. The first level of trickiness for me is that I don't know that I know what's best. So manipulating contextual relationships to get an outcome is always a question that I think we should take great pause. Now, I've said that because I really do believe that many of the circumstances of my life, and I'm sure of yours, that have been the absolute worst, that if I could have had tools to manipulate the context to not go into those disastrous moments, I would have. And with hindsight, I'm very aware that had I would have eliminated possibilities for not only learning, but mutual learning. And ultimately, I wouldn't give those experiences back. Now, some of them, in my case, have even been life-threatening experiences. So I'm not speaking from a purely silver spoon perspective here. It's a very tricky one. You know, part of the way that change happens is that it needs to change, that learning has to be real. So if the manipulation is about averting the learning, that's not going to work. That's not going to maybe be a good thing. And I don't know who you or I are to make that call. At the same time, I do feel very definitively like we are looking at a world right now that's in a state of pretty dramatic transformation and transition. and that I am called from deep within myself to respond to the struggle and the pain that I see that there are millions of people in right now, and ways in which I might be able to do something to at least somehow allow the learning to take place in a way that's a little bit less painful. The linear strategy is always a disaster. Unless you're talking about fixing trucks or building rocket ships, that linearity is just a disaster in human relations. And the real trick of it is that sometimes it works for a minute. You know, you can have a child that misbehaves and you can punish them and they won't do that thing again. And you think, ah, it's been a success. I had a strategy, I enacted the action, and now I have the result that I wanted. But ultimately what happens is that child learns to trust you a little less. That child learns to do things in ways in which that they don't get seen doing it. That child learns, what has the child actually learned? Did the child learn not just to do that deed? Or did the child learn that that deed was part of a set of deeds that they're not supposed to be in, that they will be unloved for, that they will be punished for? Did they learn that punishment is part of our interaction? What does that mean? And so on and so forth. So the problem with those linearities is that they short-circuit the complexities. So when we're talking about contextual learning, ultimately, I think what we're talking about is multimodal. It's iterative. And the word that I would use is more along the lines of curation. How would you design or curate a set of circumstances that provide the conditions through which there will be learning? Now, if you have a predetermined idea of what you want that learning to be, there's going to be trouble. Again, you've short-circuited it with slightly more complex rigging. You've enacted a linear program. So part of this process is also the authenticity of the process itself.
Great. So I want to keep probing this because I'm personally very interested, since the kind of curating circumstances is what, you know, as an educator and a teacher is what I'm doing all the time. You know, a book is a curated learning opportunity. A course is a curated learning circumstance, a retreat. And of course I agree with you that if I have some rigid sense of an outcome that I want, then I'm exactly short-circuiting the process because I'm inevitably, consciously or unconsciously, going to create a circumstance designed to generate that outcome and at the exclusion of all others. And yet, I'm using some guidance system to create the circumstances aren't random. I am using, and this leads me kind of in the next domain. I think this will lead into the next domain, that the guidance system for the curation is not a goal or a set of ideas about a better possibility, but it's more of an aesthetic sense of not what will get me to the possibility that I think is best, but what will expand the domain of possibility. And so, again, in the American philosophical tradition, the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, which I'm sure you're familiar with, his motto was never block the road to inquiry. So the idea is you never want to use any inquiry to come to the end of inquiry, that inquiry is supposed to open up the possibility for more inquiry. And so I think there's some sensibility, some aesthetic sensibility of that guides that curation in some vague direction of increasing the field of possibility that doesn't limit what can come out of it, but actually expands what can come out of it. And then you have to, you know, then it's a learning system. So what comes out of it is going to affect you and affect every, and you know, unfortunately or fortunately, I guess, we don't get to control the direction of growth. But we do seem to be able to nurture more growth in the way that we curate.
Okay, I'm going to bring that down to earth. Let's look at our world. And by our world, I'm speaking of the Western civilization arrangement. So we have a somathesy that we are living within. And in each of our institutions that we are in relationship to, in interdependent with, there are a repeating set of patterns. These patterns have everything to do with breaking things into parts. So you look at economics and the way that economics separates one category from another, one market from another, one class from another, etc. Okay? Then we look at medicine, and we look at the way the medical model separates the body. You have a heart specialist, you have a brain specialist, you have eye specialists, and thank God we do. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm just illustrating the pattern here. No judgment, just a pattern. Then you look at our education system, and again, we separate the subjects out. There's this separation. Then we look at what might be another system. I don't know. Religion. And again, you get these separations are coming in. So there is an aesthetic. There is a set of patterns within this somathesy that we are inside of. And so then when we look at something else, ecology, you know, a field, a child, an idea, a poem. The impetus is to take that grid that we have been taught and we've lived in, and to place it on anything that we see. We have somathicized that grid. So when we're talking about this notion of curation, what we have is the perfect curation of mutual learning taking place here. We have multi-modes. We have all these different places in which the same patterns are emerging. And us in the middle of all of that, we go bopping in between them. And in that bopping of in-betweenness, what we're doing is contextualizing and learning to be in this mutual relationship. We are taking it into account. We're learning how to be inside of that. That's why it's so potent. Because no one's telling you what to think or how to be or that you have to be successful in this. It's just written in the interaction, in the interdependency everywhere, that this is how you know, this is how you have authority, this is how you interact, this is how you solve problems, this is how you think about things. And this is why, you know, in the work of thinking about new paradigms, I really wanted to bring this notion of somathesy to the surface. As a way to enter into the question of, if we're going to talk about a new way of learning to be in our world, that means that our interaction with all these institutions needs to happen in a different aesthetic. It's the problem's not in the institutions. It's between them. Mm-hmm. It's in the patterns that we are living into, we're learning into, and that we stick on everything we touch. Yeah.
Beautiful. It was clear. It didn't quite answer the question for me that I was looking for, okay. But it was clear. But that's what I was trying to rethink the question. You know, so this is partly a personal question, which is good. That's a good kind of question to have. So I'm curating circumstances all the time, and I'm doing my best to curate them to facilitate new possibilities for individuals. And I try to curate them according to what I try to do is eliminate the things. I mean, you know, it's very, you know, how do you do it? You know, you don't really know what you're doing, but you're trying to look for obvious blinders, you know, and how can you remove at least the obvious blinders that you see? So for instance, in one of the courses I do, I do guided discussions, and the way that I guide the discussions is to say that what matters is that you speak to the best that you can from a place that feels very unknown to you, and that you listen as best you can from a place that doesn't know. And so it doesn't. So the content that comes out is not as important as the context of where it is you're speaking from and where you're listening from. And it results in some very wild discussions that if you record them and played them for other people, it would be very difficult to tell what the learning actually was sometimes. And yet the result of those discussions is that an aesthetic space of what I would want to call an aesthetic space of possibility opens up, where it leaves us with many more questions and uncertainties than we don't really generally come to anything. You know, there are insights that pop up in the middle that can be amazing, but really the overall sense is a deeper recognition of not knowing. So that would be an example. And I guess I'm asking this question because I'm curious to sort of benefit from your wisdom in terms of your own curations. What is the aesthetic? Are there aesthetic sensibilities that you... Because I feel like in your work, if you read this book, it has the same exact feeling of those discussions. You don't read this book and then walk away and go, oh, good, now I learned a whole bunch of things. You do, of course. There's all kinds of things in here to learn. But it's very obvious, almost on every page, that whatever it is you're learning is not really the point. That the point is this book is a holder for an aesthetic quality, for a way of being, for a perceptual possibility that is much more open-ended than any kind of accumulation of knowledge or even insight and wisdom. It's, you know, for those of you who might be curious, and I hope that all of you will be who listen to this, you know, what the book does is it's in this very interesting way. It's constantly giving you this very interesting food for thought. And then sort of just at the moment when you feel like maybe you're getting something, it pulls it out from underneath you. And so you keep entering into a space that I see as very similar to what Charles Sanders Peirce was pointing to, which is you're never closing down on something. You're always opening up. So this book is a curation of a space of possibility. At least that would be the language I would want to use. And I'm just curious, as you know, for you as a teacher, because of the many things that you are, one is an educator and a teacher. And I know that you're not teaching in a traditional sense. And I, you know, I'm aware that you are opening people up. That's, you know, you're opening people's minds. You're opening them into something that's new. And I'm curious how, as a teacher, what is the guidance system for your own curation? Just because I'm always wondering what should be the guidance system of my curation. And I have a lot of respect for your work and for the space that you open up for me whenever we speak or when I read what you're, you know, I think you're a very unique, I don't even want to call you a thinker because it's, you know, this feels so like things in space, but you're a unique space for possibility. And you may be totally intuitive and you have no idea, and it may be better if that's the case, but I'm just curious.
Well, I think, first of all, thank you. That's very kind of you. I think that it's interesting and somehow playful to recognize that we can receive different sorts of information through sort of different aspects of ourselves. And to curate a space for learning is kind of to recognize that we have those different aspects of ourselves, and that if learning's going to take place, it's going to take place between those different aspects of ourselves. So one of those aspects might be very personal and intimate and emotional. One of them might be professional. One of them might be artistic. One of them might be mathematical or more scientific, or really very identified with a particular culture or religion or history. So I like to think about what happens when you take the dropper and you drop a little piece of something in there, a little golden drip of whatever it is. And how does that kind of soak in and form an interaction in all these different sort of contextual versions of ourselves? So that would be the kind of internal curation. So that's why part of this book is, I mean, really personal. And some of it is really not personal. And I know that that's an uncomfortable sort of tandem to put things in, because I'm asking people to be both and to recognize both sides, both of those sides of yourself. And I'm saying both like there's only two. There's several sides of self that are in there. Not the least of which is actually about the intergenerational learning, which is kind of another way of framing this, that you are connected to your ancestors. You are an extension of your parents in some way and those who came before, but you're also part of what comes after. And so that is, again, that sort of transcontextual, multimodal way in which learning is taking place through these different aspects of ourselves, whether we're paying attention or not. And that's the big one, is that I think that this notion of curation is always happening. And maybe what you're getting at is how do you think about curating it? How do you do that with this thing that people refer to as intention? What the hell is intention when it comes to that? And for me, that intention has to do with the recognition of this property of mutual learning that is multimodal. I think one of the reasons we hated going to school is that there wasn't enough modality present. You would go from math to English to science to social studies, but the room was the same, the tone was the same, you know, that sort of the Snoopy's version of teachers, wah, 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 that sort of says it all. That there is a multiplicity of voice that takes place in who you really are, in what really speaks to you. It's going to come in many different ways. And Pierce talked about abduction. Ultimately, I think that that's kind of what we're talking about. I don't mean stealing children. I mean that we can look at one context and see how what we learned in that context might apply to another context. Poetry asks you to do that. Life, in fact, asks you to do that. Part of what we learn in school is how to be in our societies. While we might think that getting an education is about learning something, mostly it's about enculturating, learning how to be in our world. And that is an abductive process, this sort of scenario that I just drew out a second ago of the pattern repeating in different institutional places is the sort of the way of looking through that lens that Pierce is suggesting and saying, look at how you can see. What do you learn about one system from studying another? This is not really authorized. You're not supposed to study Edgar Allan Poe to learn about biology. We're not supposed to do that. That's not how our structures are set up. But you know what? We do it anyway. So it's just a matter of sort of recognizing that and giving space to it, giving authorization to it, allowing that complexity to be there without ridiculing it. And I think that's an important step. Again, where it goes, I don't know. But certainly I think the aesthetic of even the meta messaging there of what's possible to learn, what's possible to have inquiry around, that changes everything.
That's great. And I think in hearing that kind of sparked for me a few things. But one is, and I'm going to just take a stab at this and then see how you respond to it. But it sounds like the curation that you are speaking of, and I realize it's always going to be tricky whenever we try to nail something down into a definition. And I think for someone like you, there will always be an instinct to not want to pin something down because that is already kind of runs the risk of anchoring it in something in the current paradigm. But running that risk, I would say that what I was hearing is that the curation that you're describing, activates and optimizes the possibility for relational mutual learning. You know that. So I'm imagining that it's kind of ringing true in my experience reading your book. I'll go see you speak tonight. I'm sure, you know, that will be a place where, you know, the way things are anyway, which is that everything is always relational mutual learning, but you can curate opportunities where that can be optimized, where it can be activated, because we live in a world that's not optimizing that right now because we're not thinking of it that way. We're not engaging with reality that way. We're minimizing in some ways the opportunities for that kind of relational mutual learning. And I'm sure that tonight when I see you speak, there will be a constant opportunity to, you know, for that new aesthetic to emerge, which will take us wherever it takes us. I would love you to just at least briefly respond to that. I can tell by looking at your face, which no one can see but me, that that's at least marginally appealing as a definition.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it. The question is, when you make the connections, when you inside you or inside whatever system we're talking about, when those connections get made, and they're going to happen very uniquely in you, where do they lead you? So right now, if we are dealing with any kind of a difficult situation, and we have the instinct to solve that situation, the way we approach it is going to be somewhat destructive of the interdependencies that have been the circumstances in which that situation happened. I mean, it's par for the course. Mm-hmm. We look at an addict and we see this addiction and we send them to rehab.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's the response. Now, it may be that we get some positive results sometimes with that treatment. But I would like to ask, what kind of other treatments could we begin to develop that actually are going to address and challenge the more contextual relationships that that person is within into state of mutual learning collectively? I mean, mutual, collective. So the problem's not in the addict, but we want the solution to apply only to the addict and leave the rest of the somatheci, the ecology, as it was. So how could we begin to ask another set of questions about how to respond to very difficult circumstances that would allow everyone within them to learn, to be part of it, to move into another way so that we don't have these kind of temporary short circuits? One of the things I'm interested in this is paradox. This is something that comes up in the book a couple of times, and I'm sure it ties into your philosophical work as well, and our comfort with paradox, which is, I think, imperative for the future, is that we really develop an appetite, not for solution, but for paradox. And not because it's cute or it's tricky, but because it's really valuable and practical. Let me explain. So we have this, you know, in philosophy, the big question, the will, right? Is there will? Is there agency? And this is a tricky question when you start looking through ecological eyes, because what do we mean by that? What is leadership? What is agency? What is the will in an ecology? Do only humans have will? Does a tree have will? Can a tree choose? So the paradox that I've been playing with around this is the paradox that says, okay, I am Nora, and I'm a unique collection of filters and experiences, of genetics, of culture, of education, of whatever it is that have formed the way in which I make sense of the world. My epistemology is totally uniquely mine. Right? Mm-hmm. I see that pen in a way that is the way that I see that pen, and there are no others that will make sense of the pen in exactly the way that I have. And in that sense, I'm definitely me. But this is the paradox of this. There's no aspect of me that I can point to that isn't influenced and hasn't been part of mutual learning processes with the contextual interdependencies that I have been within since before I was born. So am I me? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I'm not me. There's no place that I can point to in me and say, that's mine. That's right. Me. I am not me. And yet, I am me. Okay, now here's the itch, is to come down on one side of that paradox or the other. And a big part of what I'm working with is stepping back from that itch and saying, no, just leave the paradox. Just leave it. There is a bias. You have a bias. You have this epistemological frame. You have the what makes Jeff go around Jeffing. And when Jeff sees that pen, Jeff Jeffifies it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's you. That's all you can do is go around Jeffing. And all I can do is go around Noraing. But there's no part of that that is not informed by my context. So if I suddenly decide to quit smoking or move to Sweden, where does that decision come from? that choice, that will? Does that come from that sense of agency that is my own epistemology? But take into account that that is totally formed and informed by the contexts that have formed those experiences and filters and understandings and strengths and weaknesses and blind spots and sensitivities. So if I want to begin to make change, I think it's important to really start with that paradox and not solve it. Mm. So that it's not the addict's fault they didn't quit. And it's not the family's fault that they didn't talk to their children in the right way when they were growing up. But somehow, if they're going to move forward into a new paradigm, both of those processes are going to have to be part of the going forwardness. So I think that's really important. And it's far too easy in a mechanistic model to plop yourself down on one side or the other of that paradox. And, you know, we get this fascination with leadership, with celebrity, with individuality, with decision-making, with manipulating circumstances.
Well, I think I want to ask one last question. I want to give it a preamble. Then I want to read a quote, a short quote from the book that really gets to a lot of the heart of what I think is important. I mean, there's so many things that are important, but there's... It stuck. I wrote down this quote because I wanted to use it, so I'm going to use it because I thought it was important. So we're talking, you could say, generally about a shift in paradigm. And Thomas Kuhn wrote The Structures of Scientific Revolution, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and he defined paradigms in a very interesting way. And you just reiterated more or less that definition a few minutes ago, where basically he says a paradigm tells you what's true. It tells you what kinds of questions you can ask about what's true. And it tells you how you can evaluate the answers to those questions. And therefore it creates a closed loop in which more inquiry inside that system isn't necessarily going to help. Because you start with a belief about what's true, and then you enter into a mechanism of inquiry that's designed to bring you back to that belief. And every time you inquire, you essentially reinforce your belief in the assumptions you started with. So in a way, even your sincere efforts at inquiry can become part of a self-fulfilling prophecy that's actually getting you more and more entrenched in your current belief system. So he talked about paradigms in his study of the history of science occur in three different ways. They occur when there is some persistent problem which your current inquiry mechanisms can't solve, and if it persists long enough, you eventually start to question your questioning. They occur when you experience something that shouldn't be possible. And therefore, you have to question your assumptions. And then sometimes they occur through, you know, what he somewhat reluctantly said were like mystical insights that a scientist will just have for no apparent reason and will stick to it long enough. And eventually a paradigm shift occurs around that. And I think that part of the way that I work and part of the way that you work is attempting to facilitate this kind of shift. So earlier I said a little bit about wormhole inquiry. I try to facilitate people inquiring assumptions about life that are so deep that the inquiry itself can unseat you from your current worldview. And I often tell people that the way that I talk about this idea of wormhole inquiry is a wormhole is a hypothetical scientific term that means that two separate, seemingly separate places in space are connected by a wormhole, which doesn't exist in time or space. So if you go in one end, you come out the other in a completely different place. And you know, I equate many of my own spiritual experiences to that. You're sitting here meditating, and then the next minute you're somewhere completely different. And so by engaging in a certain kind of inquiry, I think you create the possibility for that kind of shift in awareness. And what I often will tell people is the way it works is you take your current, you know, some current assumption about reality, and then you compare it to a completely different alternative. And you keep comparing it until you get to the place where they're equally plausible. And I often say, I don't want to go to the place where the new one is more plausible, because then you just go from one fixed position to a new fixed position. But that place where you actually don't know which is true, and you just keep opening up into the space in which two equally plausible explanations for your experience, you know, are sort of equally valid, and it creates this unknownness. And I feel like, in many ways, a lot of what's in your book and in your teaching operates in that way. It says, you know, like you were just doing now, on the one hand, I'm me. On the other hand, there's nothing about me that's me. And you know, you don't want to fall on one side or the other, you were saying. You want to be in the place where you're holding paradox. And I think when you do that with questions that are very fundamental, like, who am I? You're creating an incredible opportunity for some space to open up. And so the quote I want to read is this one that says, "There are depths at which ideas of how the world is put together are so integrated into life that they have become invisible. Those are the ones to watch out for. They sustain other ideas and ideas about ideas. They seem unchangeable, but pull a single thread loose and the whole tapestry can be reorganized." And in some ways, I just feel that that quote encapsulates at least what thrills me about philosophy and inquiry. That there are ideas that are pillars to the whole perceptual world that we live in, and they can be gently questioned. You know, you don't have to kick them out from under you, but you just gently question them. And if you do it in the right way, sometimes something, like you said, the whole tapestry starts to unravel. And I would love to just hear you reflect a little on your own experience of that and how that works in your own work and whatever arises in this space of mutual learning that we're in.
Let's see. I'm trying to think if I can think of the perfect story to put in here. I mean, I guess one thing is just to kind of go back to the kind of landscape in the book. Because when we're talking about those things that are so deep, they permeate everything and they get reinforced by everything. So when they're suddenly shifted, all the external processes and internal processes that would be reinforcing them suddenly don't. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of traveling to a distant culture that was radically different from your own. Mm-hmm. You can go to that place and you can have culture shock, and you can sort of, you know, playfully or, you know, despairingly struggle through whatever the differences are in your culture. And that's one thing. The really crazy thing is when you come home and you walk into the Safeway or the supermarket or the, you know, whatever it is that is like the most non-culture experience that you can think of that turns out to be this radical. You walk in there and suddenly your eyes are bugging out and you think, this is normal. This is how we do this thing. Why do we have 17 different kinds of detergent? Why is this building an entire city block, and so on and so forth? And all the things that you never even saw before suddenly stick out in this way. those things were invisible before. Now, the flip side of that is, so I moved to Sweden, and in Sweden they have moose. And there are these great signs, these hilarious signs of these moose running across the road. I've never seen a moose run, but apparently they run across the road. They're cute. These signs are cute. But it's actually not a laughing matter. There are moose, and a moose is a large thing to bump into with your car. So my husband is always trying to teach me how to see the moose, because they hide just behind the first row of trees along the side of the road. Now, I got to tell you, I can't see that moose. I can't see it. But if I'm walking along a trail in Northern California and the light is just right and the night's been cold and the sun is shining and I'm in a particular place at a particular time, I can tell you from somewhere deep down inside me that this is the moment you watch out for rattlesnakes. I know that it's time to look out for rattlesnakes in those moments. I know how to see them. But I have no idea how to see the moose. Now, a moose, without argument, is a much larger thing to not see than a rattlesnake. And probably much more deadly if it bumps, if you smash into it with your car. So, how do we see or perceive that which is outside of our habits of perception? And, you know, I think those are pretty practical examples of what we're talking about at a philosophical level. And, you know, the example also of reverse culture shock, where you start to see aspects of your own culture that you never noticed before because it was just the water you swam in. So it wasn't something that you could point to with that difference that makes a difference, that contrasting possibility. But also the deep samathasy of knowing. How do I know where the rattlesnakes are? Well, I don't know how I know. Is that conscious knowing? Is it at the level of verbal training? Was I trained? No. I wasn't trained how to find out where the rattlesnakes are. There's a way in which there's the combination of physical and emotional, of contextual, external, internal processes come together to allow for sensitivities. And so, I mean, I think what we're actually talking about is going through a period globally of time when we don't know where we're going. We can't see the rattlesnakes or the moose. And how do we help each other? How do we go into this as a together in mutual learning? And by together, I mean culturally and also with the other species on our planet. We're all moving together into different patterns of climate, of economics, of patterns of human interaction, not only with other humans, but with the natural world. So how can we begin to become more familiar and ask, hopefully, better questions around mutual learning? Because I don't think that even the rattlesnakes know how they're going to behave in climate change or in, you know, so everybody's off their patterns in these moments of big transformation. It's like, I don't know, I think it's a process maybe of something like swimming lessons for complexity. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a matter of mapping it out and charting a course. It's a matter of conditioning ourselves to be more likely to be able to respond in ways that are more sensitive than we have.
Well, thank you so much, Nora. I think that brings this part of our conversation to an end, and that was a great note to end on. And I want to thank you for being here and for everything that you do and all the work that you're doing and everything you have to share. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I feel just exactly the same way about talking to you. So let's do this more often.
Definitely. Thank you.